Hey there.
Hi there.
We are here to do part two of this episode on this very, very fascinating episode of Hannibal.
And of course, the show is A Second Helping of Hannibal, a spoiler-full podcast. And I am Matt.
And I'm Beth.
All right. So this was a good rewatch.
I agree.
I'd really like to do a Godfather saga cut of the first few episodes of this season and rearrange them in chronological order and just see if that works. I don't know why I want to do that. The Godfather saga cut is useful, but not necessary.
It's not necessary and it's inferior
to the two separate movies.
Yes.
Have you watched the Godfather saga cut more than once all the way through?
Probably not more than once.
Have you watched Godfather 1 and 2 more than once?
Many times more than once.
I couldn't get that question out with a straight face. Yeah, I think so. Maybe I should just leave it then. But I do think it would be kind of fun to watch them in order.
Well, I think you would have a fun, that would be a fun project for you.
I went down one rabbit hole, but I think I'll just do it when we get to the scene that the rabbit hole deals with.
Okay.
Unless you think I should just go down the rabbit hole now.
Which scene is it related to?
It's related to when Alana says she's always been interested in the word defenestration.
Well, why don't you just jump into that and then we could move on.
Okay. It might actually provide some context for the show. So there's this scene, obviously, where Chilton goes and visits Alana in the hospital. And she says something to the effect of, I've always liked the word defenestration, but now I get to use it in conversation.
In casual conversation.
Yeah, which is just such a strange thing to say about the word defenestration. But then I started thinking, if you actually were interested in the word defenestration and started poking at it, what would it reveal? So putting myself in Alana's head, I started researching the word defenestration. And it's, like anything, an interesting topic when you start to dig into it. If you have a lot of time to hang out in a hospital bed and do research, certainly you could get some interesting things about defenestration. So I'm going to discuss it then. So the definition of defenestrate is literally to throw someone out a window. Though in modern usage, it can be used to describe the removal of someone from power. So it has those dual definitions, literally throwing someone out a window, but you can also say that a politician has been defenestrated by being voted out of office or impeached or something like that. I think it's just jumped out at me in this context because it's a pretty aggressive word and it's kind of tailor-made for Hannibal because it sounds almost like a medical term. To my ear, it does anyway. And I think it's because it reminds me a bit of the word debriding.
Mm-hmm.
And debriding refers to removing damaged tissue from a wound. But it also gets used to describe the process of cleaning dead tissue off bones. Now, these are only my associations I'm making in this context. Obviously, I don't think it's meant to refer to the word debriding. Did you know that people who are into skeletons for whatever reason use maggots to clean the skeletons to do debriding of the flesh of skeletons? You did know that.
Yes.
And naturalists and museum curators who do this use these beetles called dermastid beetles to clean skeletons. And this is a totally normal and frequently employed practice at museums.
Yes.
You knew all about this.
Yes. This I know from, you know, work-related things.
Oh, yeah. So you knew from work-related things that these animals debride corpses, but that it's used deliberately to clean bones and skulls and things like that.
Yes.
I knew about it because I'm just a nerd, but it's an interesting thing. Anyway, okay, so we're not talking about debriding, though. So anyway, it turns out that there's a good reason why this word for throwing someone out a window also gets used to describe political removal beyond the obvious metaphor of falling. And that's because historically, defenestration was actually used for political assassination or as a form of public punishment for political agitators.
Got it.
So have you heard of the defenestration of Prague?
No.
Okay. So if you were a student of history or a student of early modern history, you'd really know about the defenestration of Prague. You know, do you know about the 30 Years' War? You know the term the 30 Years' War, right?
Yes.
But you probably don't really know what the 30 Years' War was about.
If I did, I don't remember.
Right. So basically, the defenestration of Prague was an expression of the growing antipathy between Bohemian Protestants and the dominant Catholic Habsburg Empire, which is what the 30 Years' War was about.
Okay.
And so the defenestration of Prague, during a hearing where some Protestant lords were airing their grievances about being stripped from power, they threw two Catholic lords regent out the window of a chancellery. And this happened in 1618. And this is what triggered the first battle of the 30 Years' War, which was this big Catholic-Protestant war between the Bohemian Protestants and the Habsburgs. And the weird thing is the two people who got thrown out the window survived, and the Catholics maintained that the Virgin Mary intervened to save them. And the Protestants said they survived because they fell into a pile of shit, dung. But it's probably actually because the wall of the castle sloped outward and slowed their fall. So these competing assertions of why they survived may have been rooted in this longstanding idea that if you were holy or pious enough, you would be saved from a fall. And if you did fall to your death, it meant that you spiritually deserved it. So it was almost like whether witches would float or not, could you fall to your death or not? And in general, falling is a metaphor for falling from grace, starting with Satan, right, is the first fallen angel. So there's that. So most of this information I'm getting is coming from this article I came across online in the Journal of Modern History by this NYU professor, Daniel Jute. And it's this great academic article. It's wonderfully academic in all the best ways because it really digs into theories about things you wouldn't think about, like the role of windows in early modern Europe, you know, specifically that windows were important symbols of status. Ornate, soaring, well-placed windows with painterly views was not something everyone could come by. And there was this whole kind of status and wealth and prestige associated with having these beautifully placed windows. And from the outside, windows were important for politicians and nobility to display their status. So if they had a window overlooking a public square, they could literally look down on the masses, almost like a religious figure. And if they wanted to advertise their largesse or curry favor, they could also do things like throw money or bread or food from their windows. So I didn't realize this because I don't know my Old Testament stuff very well, but it also seems that Jezebel, who of course is the famed idol worshiper, whose name is synonymous now with moral corruption, was killed via defenestration. So I'm going to read the passage from this paper for a minute. In Kings 2, we find the story of Jezebel, the powerful wife of the king of northern Israel, who ridiculed Commander Yehu from a window. The enraged Yehu, who later became king, ordered some of the servants who were standing near her to hurl Jezebel out the window. And he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trod her underfoot. That last bit was a quote. And then dogs then mauled Jezebel's body until there was nothing left apart from, quote, the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. So in this biblical story, the setting for the scene is a palace. And it's made clear, says this paper, that the defenestration is not an arbitrary act, but rather a targeted and, by Old Testament standards, legitimate punishment. And it goes on to say, one significant detail links Jezebel's story with many of the later defenestrations. They were all intentional acts of violence inflicted upon oppressors of true religion. And so this is sort of a bonus for me and my research here, or whatever you call this, because the story of Jezebel involves both defenestration and debriding, which I was thinking by an animal. And we can't ignore the fact that Hannibal fans can't ignore the fact that dogs did the debriding, right? And one other light Hannibal connection from the ancient world now is that there's a reference to defenestration in Dante in the Divine Comedy. He mentions this thing called the Tarpeian Rock, which was a cliff that people convicted of treason would be thrown off in ancient Rome. Do you know the term Tarpeian Rock? Okay.
No.
You were nodding, so I was like,
no.
Maybe that's just the thing everyone knows that I don't know.
No.
So something possibly interesting in this digression is that defenestration was a big form of punishment in medieval Florence. So there's a famous palace in Florence called the Palazzo Vecchio.
The old palace.
You know Florence? And it's allegedly haunted by the ghost of a man named Baldaccio. And Baldaccio was an Italian mercenary who was sort of famous at the time for his exploits. Baldaccio worried the Medici because he was getting too famous and too powerful. So the Medici threw him out a window of the Palazzo Vecchio, and then he was decapitated after his body landed on the ground because he didn't die. And this incident became so well known in Florence that the phrase fare il salto di Baldaccio, or to make Baldaccio's jump, became a slang phrase for getting thrown out a window. And so getting thrown out a window was such a big thing that there was actually a slang phrase for it. And by the 1600s, defenestration became synonymous with political punishment. And throughout the 1400s and 1500s, political assassinations and deadly conflicts often ended with the victim or the defeated party being either hung from or thrown out a window into the piazza. And so the last one I'll mention here, because it has a thin tendril of a connection to Hannibal, is in 1478, there was a coup attempt made with the Pope's tacit support against the Medici, who were the Florentine rulers, right? People were gunning for them all the time. And the leaders of the coup were foiled, and many of them were killed by defenestration or at least hung from the windows. And do you know who the leader of the coup was?
No.
Francesco de Pazzi.
Well, I think this is brought up later. Brought up later in this. I know this is in the books. I remember this is in the books.
Okay.
And I think, I don't remember if it gets brought up in the series, but Pazzi is a descendant. And so he has this history that's attached to him. And I can't recall if this gets raised, because I believe that this is how Pazzi dies in the TV series. Hannibal hangs him out the window, right? Isn't that correct?
Uh-huh.
So I think...
And that's a thing that happens in Gialli a lot, people get hung out windows.
That's an Italian tradition.
So how about that? So this incident's called, it's called the Pazzi Conspiracy. And so this guy had actually gone to the Pope and got a tacit endorsement to do this. But then I just started thinking, Pope Sixtus, you and I are very much alike. We both want to see the Medici removed from power.
From power. He has those funny pauses.
Power. Yes. Yeah, from power. So how about that? There's a roundabout but unbroken line from defenestration to Pazzi.
So I think we have to revisit this later when we see what happens to Pazzi. And I just don't recall if this is just discussed in the books or maybe in the movies, but not in the TV show, but it may be discussed later in the TV show. We're going to have to see. The other thing is, it's kind of interesting that Alana survives defenestration, which would suggest, based on the history you've provided, that one would assume she's got a kind of grace, right? That she has survived this being thrown out the window. And it's a biblical form of retribution from the Old Testament. And in this episode, she talks about Old Testament revenge and not being averse to it. So you could say Alana wants some form of Old Testament revenge, or she's professing to, because Old Testament revenge has been visited on her.
Yeah, and she is very explicitly saying she was raised religious, but she's not interested in the old religion, and that she has other ways of getting revenge that aren't Old Testament revenge, or that are like Old Testament revenge, but aren't religiously oriented. And that is Jezebel, right?
Yes, yes. Well, if you're a powerful woman, you're going out the window one way or another.
100%.
And Alana wakes with a halo. She has a halo. I mean,
that's the thing. I mean, we were talking about this last time. I think the death and resurrection imagery is strongest around Alana in this episode, and references to change and transformation. I mean, everyone's got it, but it's so explicit with her laying there with that halo around her.
Yeah, it's interesting. To me, I think it's even stronger with Jack because of the cut from his blood to the sort of heavenly, the celestial sky.
Yeah, interesting too that Jack rises to heaven and she has this fall to hell,
yes,
kind of.
Which drags yeah. herself out of it one way or another, survives it.
Yeah, so I think this stuff is all in the atmosphere.
And we're going to have to come back to it with Potsy for sure when we see him inexorably making his way to meeting his end.
I'm glad you made that connection, because I really didn't know why I was going down this rabbit hole with defenestration, except it was just plain interesting when you start reading about it.
Yeah.
I actually wrote to the professor who wrote that article to see if he would come on the podcast.
And no go.
He wrote me a very nice response, but he was like, I'm kind of busy.
All right. So defenestration, we're going to come back to, obviously, because we're going to be dealing with Potsy. One thing is, we had raised, I have a number of things, but we had raised a few questions last time that we wanted to pay attention to, and maybe we can talk about a couple of these.
Yes.
I had some thoughts on the question of, we talked about, Chilton says you'll leave it here under a cloud of suspicion, and Will says not a cloud, a fog, and we were wondering why. And this was my thinking about it. A cloud of suspicion has to do with how others are perceiving you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, so it's how you're seen from someone else's perspective. A fog has to do with your own perceptions, or the impediment to your own perception. It's not a cloud for Will. Will doesn't care right now about how anybody else perceives him. He is not interested in how anyone else perceives him. In fact, he makes very concerted efforts to push every connection he has away from him. I think saying he's in a fog has to do with the relative uncertainty of his own perspective. Like, when you're in a fog, your way forward is unclear. And what, after his visit from Chilton, as we've seen in Primavera and as we see throughout this episode, he is working his way to get to a place where he has made a decision, or he has more certainty about his feelings, about what he's going to do next and what he's going to do in reference to Hannibal. And he is going to reach a point where the fog clears. So that was my thinking about that, why cloud versus fog.
But I do feel like he's not that foggy in his understanding of where he stands.
But you have to remember, when we start this episode, we are where he's at when he starts his conversations with Abigail in Primavera. So he's not yet. When he's in the hospital talking to Chilton, he hasn't yet had that
That's true.
That's conversation with Mind Palace Abigail, gelled. Which is himself. So at this point, the point where he's getting ready to leave the hospital, it's not that clear to him. It's becoming clear to him. But he's still going to be arguing with himself. And those arguments are going to continue with himself all the way until after he's in Florence. So I just think that that may be what, that's one way of looking at this in any event.
Right. That makes sense.
Another question we had, which I have less of an answer to, is that line, "You were so afraid of me the last time I saw you before the last time I saw you." I still don't really have an answer to this. And what's the difference between those two things? Is it just Hannibal's voice you're hearing? Or is Will's voice in there? Or someone else's voice in there?
Yeah. I thought that listening closely to that voiceover, there is a double voice. So the line before, "You were afraid of me before," that second part of the line is in a double voice. The first part of the line is just Hannibal. The second part has an echo, and I think Will's voice is underneath it. If you listen really carefully, you could hear there's two voices there.
It sounded like two voices, but I couldn't tell if it was the same voice twice or another voice.
Well, I think this is almost like the audio equivalent of that Will splitting visual that mm-hmm. we saw earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what she's hearing is Hannibal saying, "You were so afraid of me the last time I saw you." And Will is saying, "Even before the last time I saw you, you were afraid of me." Because remember, Alana does all this stuff early on about being reluctant to get romantically involved with Will because she's afraid of him.
Yes, he's unstable.
He's unstable. So I think that's what's happening. I think she's having a conversation with the two of them at the same time. And both are chiming in. Does that sound about
right? Yes, yes. The other couple of things we had talked about was Chilton's clothing. That in his first two encounters, first with Mason and then with Will, he's dressed more like Will. And then in his next two encounters, he is dressed more like himself or himself imitating Hannibal.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about this?
I was watching for this. I didn't have a lot more to add to it other than the simple observation that he seems to be dressing appropriately for the occasion or who he's dealing with. And I think it indicates how consciously calculated he's being now. One thing that made me think more about how deliberate he's being, it's a very good performance. In the first scene when he's first speaking to Mason, when he says the dead have no more use for their, what does he say? The dead are done with what they've lost, but we still itch.
Yes.
He says the words "the dead" twice. Yes. He says "the dead" and he almost breaks down for a second, gathers himself, and then does his speech the way he wants to, right? He goes, "the dead," and then he has to stop and he goes, "the dead are done with what they've lost." So I think he is fighting the emotional, consciously fighting how emotionally he feels about all this while being very deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
So that just reinforces the idea that his wardrobe here would be deliberate choices. He's going through this succession of people in a very, very calculated, and as you said last time, building on each encounter to gather, to strengthen his case to the next person he talks to. The first person he talks to, Mason, is just like, basically gives me the same answer that professor gave me, which is what, like, not interested.
Mm-hmm.
By the end, he's, as you had said, he's gathered enough information and understood enough about how people are going to react that he's calculated a different way of going about it. By the time he talks to Alana, he knows how to line up someone's support.
Another thing about that I noticed on this watch, by the way, is that he, you know, he takes off his makeup and his prosthetics in front of Mason at Mason's request. In his next three meetings, he's got his prosthetic eye back and his plate is back in his mouth, but he leaves the bullet hole visible So I think he has decided, I don't want to basically show how damaged I am, but I want a reminder, a visible reminder to everybody that I am damaged by Hannibal.
And the people he talks to while he is showing that bullet hole are the people he has every right to blame for the fact that that hole is in his face.
Yes.
I was really struck in the scene with Jack. Jack is really being very Jacky asshole-y to him in that scene. And as much as I want to forgive Jack everything in this episode, Chilton deserves to be furious at Jack. He is in this position because Jack fucked up.
Yep.
Got him shot in the face.
Wouldn't listen to him.
Wouldn't listen to him and got him shot in the face.
Yep.
And that's why I thought Jack's kind of dismissiveness toward him. Jack's got a lot on his mind, but I thought it was kind of inappropriate. And I think that is, I hadn't connected it till you just said it. I think that's why he's doing it. He's saying, hey, FBI people, look at this hole in my face because you made mistakes. How about listening to me this time?
Yep. 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 Okay, that's good.
Now, one thing also, there was a smaller thing in that discussion he has with Mason. When he says the dead are done with what they've lost, he says, but we still itch for what we've lost. And like everything in this show, there's two, it's got a couple of meanings. He's saying to Mason, we're itching for revenge. Mm-hmm. But also like everything in the show, he's still talking about Will and Hannibal because Will is itching for what he's mm-hmm. lost and Hannibal is itching for mm-hmm. what he's lost. Mm-hmm. So he's really referring to this everybody's state of mind here.
Jack smarts because of what he lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's all good.
Now, can I ask you something, though, about the prosthetics scene? The rhythm of that scene really reminded me of something else. And I just feel like, is there some famous movie or something where someone's removing a prosthetic or where two people are removing prosthetics or removing, I don't know if it's spacesuits or prosthetic limbs, that they're stripping down in a way. I really, really feel like there's something familiar about the pace of that scene, and I couldn't put my finger on it.
It's not in that movie where the people go watch car crashes, right?
Crash? The David Cronenberg movie,
yeah,
Crash?
Yeah, it's not in Crash, is it?
It feels very Cronenberg-y.
You know, it's making me in a humorous way. It's got a body. In a humorous way, it's just making me think of, you know, Jaws and them showing each other their scars.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
Roy Scheider looks at his appendix scar.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give it some thought because now that you're saying this, it does seem familiar to me.
I really racked my brain for it. I couldn't figure out what it was. Is it something from a horror movie about people stripping stuff off and revealing how they really look? Phantom of the Opera was not the right association. Like we said it last time, but that's not what I'm thinking of. There's just something really, really familiar to me about it. And I just, okay.
All right. We'll think about it. Maybe if someone knows what we're referring to, let us know, please. I wanted to go back to something we were talking about last time, which is, you know, we talk about that the scene where Will tells Jack because he was my friend and I wanted to run away with him. I mean, just first of all, we mentioned it before, but this is a great performance by Hugh Dancy.
It's great.
His struggle to bring those words, like, to put that feeling into words and to actually say them is so palpable. It's just a beautiful performance. But we had kind of said last time, well, this really answers the question of whether Will was trying to thread the needle back in Mizumono, you know, back in season, throughout season two and up until Mizumono. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he really was going to come down on Hannibal's side because this is how he felt. You know, I don't know that it's as clear as a yes or no. I think Will's conflict was very real at the time. In fact, he says he didn't know, make a decision until he heard Hannibal's voice. And he may have been trying to thread the needle or hedge his bets. But now, in hindsight, he's examining his emotions and he's examining his feelings about the loss he's experiencing in Hannibal's absence. And that solidifies in his mind, this is what I wanted. This is what I wanted. This is what I would have done. This is the outcome that I would have been, that should have been achieved. So it doesn't mean he was not unconflicted at the time, particularly because we see how, we've seen the progression even of Will's memories of the events of Mizumono changing. Right? Their emphasis changes over time. Yeah. Yeah. The interpretation for him or the emotional impact of what happened in Mizumono changes in his memories of that incident. And here his emphasis is changing due to the fact that he currently wants to be with Hannibal. So this certainly being with Hannibal or killing Jack was one of the impulses he may have had at the time. But it may not have been the only, I mean, he had conflicted impulses at the time. And now it's like, yes, this is what I want. Therefore, I'm seeing my past as if this is what I even wanted then. So that's just a thought about that.
Yeah. And the way this scene opens, I was wrong about it last time. I thought Will's repairing of the engine was being intercut with Hannibal butchering someone. It's not. It's being intercut with Will's head falling out of frame after they hug.
And Hannibal gazing at him.
Yeah. There's maybe something sexual about that framing and leaving out all the stabbing and all that stuff and having Will's head just like drop off frame and Hannibal look down.
Oh, agreed.
And Will is equating that with fixing his boat and getting to Hannibal.
Yes.
And I was watching something really closely when he says that line, I wanted to run away with him. You're absolutely right. It's really, really subtle and difficult performance for Hugh Dancy. When he says, I wanted to run away with him, his eyes, up until that moment, his eyes are sort of looking down. He says, I wanted to run away with him. His eyes snap open and he looks back toward Jack. Not back toward Jack, but sideways.
Yes.
As if he's directed that statement at Jack like a stab or either like a fuck you, Jack, I just hit you with this, or maybe inviting a response or wondering if Jack is going to react and object to it. I think there's a mixture of him, what would you say, not quite spitefully, but assertively opening his eyes and looking back toward Jack like, uh-huh, get it? But also maybe even wondering if Jack is going to try to stop him or argue with him. He remains perhaps even then not quite sure if the words coming out of his mouth are exactly what he means, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because Jack will try to stop him, but he's too late. He shows up at Will's house too late.
Too late in this moment. And that was something we wanted to think more about too, that line that Alana says, do you know what you have to do? I really thought that was a response to, or that was a statement she made to him as the former student, the former employee, the former mentee, elevated to a superior position over the former mentor. Because I think maybe she's saying it because Jack is a step behind Will. Now, Jack's just wandering around without purpose. He shows up at the house. Oh, is Will here? And she's like, he's gone already, Jack. He knows what he has to do.
Get with the program, Jack.
Do you know what you have to do? It's almost like not a portentous sort of, do you know what you have to do, right? It's not a Potsy line. It's a, hey, Jack, do you even know what you're fucking doing anymore? Like, I think that's kind of what she's actually saying to him.
That makes sense.
You wandering around Will's empty house. He's got way gone already, and you should know better than to think you were going to find him here.
Yep. Yep. And now go do what you have to do.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. I wanted to talk about the cannibal sympathy card.
Okay.
There's a couple of things. Just one easier thing is, I think we see, with respect to this, what happens in this church, another way in which Hannibal and Will are very connected, because we talked about how Will makes the statement to Jack about Bella being somewhere and comfortable, and how it sounds like a platitude.
Yeah.
Or not even just sort of the kind of thing someone just said. It's an oddly appropriate, normal thing to say in this circumstance, right?
Yes.
And Hannibal has sent a sympathy card, which is also what is appropriate behavior, right? Mm-hmm. That's a courtesy, and he observes courtesies. And yet Will's statement to Jack carries other meanings, and which I think is about the multiverse, even though Jack may not understand that's what he means. And Hannibal's note to Jack, while on its purpose just a mere courtesy, also carries a number of other meanings, including that, well, as we said, like, he liked Bella despite the coin flip. He considered Jack a friend despite trying to kill Jack. And I mean, this is yet another example of Hannibal being able to hold multiple things in his mind at the same time without them feeling contradictory.
Yes. Right?
He did like Bella and is expressing sympathy for her departure, even though he was willing to put her through suffering by doing the coin flip. He really liked Jack, and in fact, Jack's being his friend was one of the reasons he was going to kill Jack, so Jack could see the real him, right?
Right.
It's also a dig at Jack, right? It's also saying, like, I escaped you in the FBI, and I'm, as Mason says, to-ing and fro-ing and having, you know, good fun times in the world, even though he really isn't. It's a way of him expressing his own grief over the loss of Will and almost expressing an empathy for Jack's loss, because he is experiencing something in terms of Will that could be equated to a death, loss.
Yeah.
And I think he knows that Jack will understand that this message is also for Will and may pass on the message to Will. So, like, all of those things are going on under the surface of what Hannibal's doing with this note, which just seems like a courtesy, a nicety to be observed. And Will is saying a lot of things under his courteous or his sort of mundane expression of sympathy.
When you use the word courtesy, it's like, of course, discourtesy is intolerable to Hannibal.
Yes, yes, yes.
Something about that envelope scene, I was actually watching it really closely to see what was in the bouquet. But when Jack picks up the envelope, did you notice that he looks up and to his left as if he's looking for someone there? And that is the same position that Hannibal was in when he was spying in the church. So I think that's a fun little connection to that Palermo scene.
Love it. Yep, that's good. One question I had about this is, you know, a tear falls on the note, but we don't see whose tear it is. And I kind of think it could equally be a tear from Jack or Hannibal falling on that note. You don't see either of them actually crying in connection to that note, but someone's tear has fallen on that note, and I guess it could be either one or both of them.
That's a good point. You don't actually see it drop out of
anybody's eye.
Yeah.
Some smaller things. Well, first of all, the music during the Will's, you know, either fantasy or vision of murdering Jack with Hannibal, is really beautiful and really plaintive. And this is just I looked it up. It's just a piece by Grieg. But one thing that I was dying. So this past week on Twitter, we have talked about what those ostrich eggs mean that were on Hannibal's table. And
yes,
someone
was asking about it.
Someone was asking about it. And I had seen this clip where Abel Gideon is sitting in front of the ostrich eggs. And they almost look like the stumps he will later have, like his later bandage stumps when Hannibal's amputated.
Yes.
But when Alana goes into the house in her wheelchair, the ostrich eggs are on the table.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know what that means. I don't know what it's in aid of, but I just couldn't believe I noticed the ostrich eggs. And I probably wouldn't have noticed them other than someone had, you know, this had been brought up on Twitter.
Do you think it could be a reference to Alien, like that cache of eggs that open up and the thing comes out and then an imago hatches out of a human body?
there's
something vaguely sci-fi about those giant eggs just lurking.
They feel very weird, and they're very noticeable in a variety of different occasions.
There's three of them,
yep.
Right? Are they supposed to represent Jack, Will, and
Hannibal?
Hannibal?
Three
of them at that table?
I don't know.
Is that fantasy sequence with the three of them at that table. That sequence, because in this episode you feel so bad for Jack, I know it's a fantasy sequence. He looks so horrified.
Betrayed.
Betrayed and terrified by, you pointed this out last time, but it's really, really so notable that he's just looks so terrified and scared and betrayed.
Yeah.
And it's very un-Jack-like. He never makes a face like that. He never screams like that. We've seen him get stabbed in the neck and him totally keep his cool.
I know, which is interesting because it's also what Will wants to see
yes.
in him. Like,
yes.
Or at least a part of him does.
Yes. And he's not going to.
He wants to see the terror. He wants to see Jack look like that when Jack sees him.
Yeah. I had a couple of small things.
Mm-hmm.
One, a movie reference. When we see that first shot of the bullet going through Chilton's head and this whole idea of seeing inside bodies, but particularly that one, it really reminded me of that David O. Russell movie, Three Kings.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 1999 movie about the aftermath of the first Iraq war.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that movie since then.
It's about as 90s as a movie could be. It's
George Clooney,
Mark Wahlberg,
and Ice Cube
as three soldiers who are leading a caper to get some of Saddam Hussein's gold from a bunker and keep it. And one of the things that George Clooney, who's an army ranger in the movie, is telling these other soldiers who have not actually seen combat is what happens to a human body when a bullet enters it. And there's a sequence where he says, here's what happens, and it cuts to the inside of the human body with a bullet plowing through it, and it punctures the liver, and bile starts going, floating out into the chest cavity or into the abdomen. But you just see this very, very anatomical thing of a bullet going through. And later in the movie, Mark Wahlberg gets a punctured lung. And you also go inside his body and see spit you see mucus and air bubbling out of this hole in his lung. And this first scene of the bullet going through Chilton's head is very, very reminiscent of that. I'm talking to you about this like I know the movie so well. I just rewatched it because I'll post a shot of that thing in the show notes. It's very, very close. Also, a really weird movie to watch now. Really strange.
Because it was before 9/11.
It is before 9/11, and it was before we re-entered Iraq and all the
everything
mess
that
occurred after that. And the whole idea of the movie is we are there, Americans are there in Iraq, and the whole tension of the movie is that they're explicitly not going after Saddam Hussein. They're specifically not toppling the regime. And the tension of that movie is that they're abandoning the Iraqi resistance to the mercies of Saddam Hussein's
regime.
And it's really weird to watch that movie with a modern eye. Mm-hmm. It's actually not a bad watch. It gets a little bit unfocused and kind of meanders around in the third act. But
I remember liking the movie at the time, but I honestly don't think I've seen it. I think I saw it in the theater and when it came out in that year, and I don't think I've seen it since.
It was pretty good. I wouldn't tell anyone Run, Don't Walk, but if you come across it, it's worth checking out. If you're a Hannibal fan, it's really worth checking out, like the first 20 minutes of it or whenever that thing occurs. But I'm going to post a shot of it in the show notes. Something else, too, about that scene is it opens, we mentioned last time, with that beautiful shot of the bullet just like whizzing by Alana's head and actually disturbing the hairs on her head as mm-hmm. it goes by. Meaning Alana literally came a hair's breadth away from having the bullet hit her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just so Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been her.
Yep.
And Hannibal would have been fine if it had just been her.
Yep.
Instead of Chilton.
Mm-hmm.
It would have just been the way of the world, and that's that. And it was that close to just putting an end to her,
mm-hmm.
or putting her directly in Chilton's position. Because we talked a little bit before about how she's almost identified with Chilton here, walking with a cane, being in his... She's the one who finally is like, yes, Frederick, let's team up.
She's the one who's actually going to be his ally going forward. Like, they are allied going forward. It's that she's made a little bit of a devil's bargain with him. But
so I thought, it, in a way, this bullet almost connected the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. It makes sense.
Saying it could have been her.
Yep, that makes sense.
So another small thing here, there's a wide shot of Will's bed when he's in the hospital that mirrors the wide shot of Mason in his bed. Which we're equating all these victims mm-hmm. of Hannibal in different ways. We're comparing and contrasting them throughout this episode. I mean, Chilton's doing it explicitly.
We see every victim in a bed, except for Chilton.
And Alana in the bed, by the way, you mentioned before, you know, how holy she looks. There's one framing where that halo around her, you see her face through it. It almost looks like she's... It's a stained glass window, and she's one of the panes in the stained glass window.
Mm-hmm.
That just that religious imagery of Alana in particular being resurrected is very strong in this episode. And I kind of want to watch future episodes to see if there's anything else about the way she's treated to give her kind of an otherworldly quality. I don't remember if that happens, but it seems to be really explicitly established there. Oh, another thing I forgot to mention before about Chilton and the way he's come to acknowledge his own flaws and the sort of deliberate way he's going about this process. When Will says compulsive imitation, maybe, he says, how dull.
Maybe.
But maybe.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, maybe I'm not so special.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says to Will, you need a friend.
Friend.
And the funny thing is when I do the second watches, I put the subtitles on so that I could catch any subtleties in dialogue. And it said, you need a friend, comma, friend. And that occurred to me that when you had said about Hannibal and Will thinking of each other that way, it almost feels like it could have been delivered as you need a friend, you know, right? Is he a friend or is he a friend? And I don't know if that's there, but hey, it was there for me. There's another kind of little double meaning in another line too, when Jack says, I hoped you would come looking for me. It's loaded because I think Jack really did hope Will would come looking for him. But it's also like, I hoped you would come looking for me instead of Hannibal. This has been Jack's project with Will. Make it me instead of Hannibal. So I feel like that line has that subtle little shading in that direction as well.
Particularly when you take it in conjunction with the fact that Jack does say we were supposed to go together, meaning to the dinner. But like you can really look at that like we were supposed to go together. Like it was us as a team.
That makes sense. Oh, something else about Alana I wanted to ask you. Did she ever eat marrow at Hannibal's table?
I don't remember.
There was a meal where he served marrow. But
he might have, but I don't remember it. And I mostly remember her saying she'd never had tongue before and eating really, really tonguey-looking tongues.
Yes, which I guess we can think about that, too, in her flirtation with
with Margot. Oh, I do want to talk about Margot and Alana for a minute. One thing is, first of all, I didn't really notice it the first time, that Margot does a total, like, looks Alana up and down.
Like, boy.
Yes. It's not, like, she starts out checking her out, but, like, afterwards, she just looks her up and down, head to toe, and back up to head again. It's just such a sexual checking out of somebody.
Yes.
Which I love. And you really, there is heat between those two immediately. Like, it really works. We didn't really talk about this because I'm sure I remember this being talked about and reading about this like back when I first watched Hannibal, but like it is really interesting and good and that they just allowed this relationship to develop between Alana and Margot without discussing like, oh, why does she like women now? Or like, it's just, she's a bisexual person or she's just fluid with her sexuality. And there's just, you don't have to.
Yeah.
And it was particularly works because the attraction between them feels real. Like it feels like a real attraction. I was also thinking that it's kind of funny because in that sex scene, you know, back in the sex scene where Will and Margot are having sex and Alana and Hannibal are having sex, but it really feels like, you know, Hannibal and Will are sort of having sex and Margot and Alana are proxies.
Yeah.
It does kind of feel like, well, they've had proxy sex already, so they might as well have real sex with each other. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it just feels like it's a completion of something that started with that scene.
Yeah. One thing about that, too, you know, because Catherine Isabella's ginger snaps.
Yep.
And it doesn't hurt that kind of sexual scene introduction that she comes from that tradition of horror movie.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
Right? Like she's not afraid to like overdo that look up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that comes out of horror movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really appropriate in that scene because things are sort of austere. Alana walks in from a different genre. She walks in from film noir.
Yep.
Or Technicolor melodrama. And Margot just comes in from an 80s horror movie like Hubba Hubba. It's really good. There's also a little line there that I really liked. I think I'd mentioned it last time when Alana says there's a witchy beauty about this place. She actually doesn't say there's a witch. She says witchy beauty about this place, and it's almost like she's using those words to describe Margot.
Yes.
Margot is the witchy beauty.
Yes.
About that
yes.
place.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Wondering about that place.
Yes. Yes.
I really like that. I didn't want to bring up more Bella stuff. It's just as hard to watch.
It's very difficult to watch.
It felt more definitive that Jack ODs her to put her out of her pain, though, on this second watch.
Interesting, because I was then questioning it on the second watch. I was pretty certain of it on the first watch, and on the second watch, I was like, really? Or is he just giving her regular medication?
She has a really rattly, notable, like loud, not loud, but there's a rattle to her breathing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he gives her that medication, and she just stops moving and stops breathing. Mm. And I don't know if because she was no longer in pain or if he just finally gave her a little extra morphine to put an end to it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell. Yeah. I felt like this time around that it was he actually accidentally on purpose gave her an overdose.
That was definitely how I felt the first time. The second time I was just questioning myself a little bit, but I do think that's what happened.
It runs too overtly counter to what Hannibal did, which is injecting her with something that saved her.
Yes.
So that's why I sort of lean toward thinking it was putting the finishing touches as opposed to you know, just a scene where he's hugging her.
Yep.
Oh, this was just a very strange coincidence. When Mason is talking about the skin grafts and getting the physical therapy. So I rewatched it yesterday. Just a weird coincidence. I also happened to speak to somebody yesterday who had just had a skin graft.
Oh my God, that's really weird because that scene is even like, I don't know, maybe the first time I was writing down some notes, but that scene is gross.
Well, to pull the leg skin off, they use what looks like a vegetable peeler.
Ooh.
There's a real connection between food and his leg being peeled.
Ugh.
The guy I spoke to yesterday was really interesting. He said he grew up with frequent ear infections and something was up with the skin in his ear. And over time, his scar tissue built up in his ear canal till it blocked his ear canal. And now he's in a middle-aged person and his ear canal is completely blocked, except that his ears work fine. His eardrum works fine and he can hear, but like it was just blocked. So he had a surgical procedure where they took the scar tissue out of his ear and then peeled a piece of his leg skin off and grafted it to the inside of his ear. And so I just sort of had this leg skin thing on my mind. And then I really noticed that they're using a vegetable peeler basically to pull that leg skin off.
It's a very gross scene to watch.
But it's still people as food, you know?
I mean, especially since Mason ate his own face.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Now, also one other wardrobe thing. When Alana is talking to Mason that second time, she's not totally film noir. She's got this open neck shirt again.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen Alana like go, we've seen Alana with these kind of open neck shirts. She's not going full wrap dress because she's got the jacket on and all that.
She's
but
sitting only in pantsuits from now on.
She's returned and she's showing more skin than she was when she initially came in. And I think that's just because she knows she's going to see Margo again.
Yes,
right?
That makes sense. Yes.
Well, that's it for me. That's all I've got too.
That's all I've got too. We did a pretty extensive conversation about this last time, and now we have another hour on it. So yeah, I think we pretty exhaustively discussed it, and now we have Contorno to look forward to.
I know. I can't wait. I'm so excited.
We're gonna keep an eye out for whether we hear more about Potsy's family history.
And the defenestration
yes.
thereof.
Yes, yes. All right, we'll be back.